sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The market bounce continues. Earnings season, not so hot. Twitter gets a boost. And our guest today, the one and only Frank Curzio, will be with us. All this and much more on episode number 434 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and you are listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me today. We do have a great guest today. I want to get to a few things before we get to Frank. Talk about some things that happened in the markets last week, some things that actually we need to be looking for next week or the week that's coming. It is the mid part of October. We did see that earnings season is off to a rather lukewarm opening. Many companies are coming in a bit under some of the earnings levels on EPS. And of course, we are seeing some concern over revenues, a lot of it being continually blamed on the strong dollar impact on what's going on with the world situation. Of course, the weak global environment that we're seeing is also being blamed on it. But nonetheless, it is not something that's very exciting. Investors seem to be off to a pretty giddy start about it, though. Looking at some of these excuses, like we saw initially from Netflix last week, where they were saying that, yeah, things are great. Unfortunately, our subscribers are down. Our revenues are down. A lot of that's to be blamed, as they said, on the new and improved credit card feature where you have chip credit cards for encryption and for security. And because of that, some people were not able to renew their subscriptions, and they blamed the idea that their softer than expected subscription base had shrunk due to that, and they thought it would be just transitory. At first, well, investors thought that was kind of cool. No problem. Stock was initially down, came back throughout the evening after the announcement of earnings to about even. And the next day, I think reality struck and the stock was down about 10% over the next couple of days. We are seeing that banks are also providing a little bit softer guidance and didn't seem to matter to investors, though. They bid up the stocks over the next couple of days after earnings came out. Goldman Sachs definitely was light. JP Morgan beat on the top line, missed on the bottom. But overall, I guess we have to really conclude that so far, where we are at this exact juncture, is that earnings season is close to the area that expectations were by analysts, but still that's not really good because earnings are declining on a quarter-over-quarter basis and a quarter-over-last quarter basis, or the 1 year before. Let's talk about some things that are happening also, that we did see that the latest inflation and retail sales readings were kind of weak, and that helped to seemingly put more of a bid under the market as the hope that the Federal Reserve will postpone any kind of rate increase well into the future. And we saw the S&P gained about almost 1% for the week, Dow about 0.75%, and the NASDAQ rose 1.16%. And this is all with the backdrop that inflation ticked up ever so slightly. The CPI headline looked like it was initially pretty soft, but if you strip out the energy and foodstuffs, actually rose 0.2%, up about 1.9% year over year. PPI at the wholesale level was pretty tame. Matter of fact, it dropped off more than was expected. Now, sometimes when I see this, I look at the PPI and the CPI, and you have to think the relationship of the two. So the first is the PPI, where companies are buying their products a lot cheaper. And if the inflation rate, or what they can charge customers for the end product, is not declining as much, the spreads are a bit better. So that's actually good for companies. But we did see that retail sales are still, it seems to be pretty soft, even in the face of consumer confidence, or the sentiment index by the Michigan University of Michigan came in at about 92.1, up about 5 points from the final September or its final September reading. So that's good for October, which was interesting. Really, in September, even with all the market turmoil, we didn't see too much of a problem there in terms of a drop in sentiment. Analysts had expected about 88.5, and so when you come in at 92, really showing that consumer sentiment is maintaining pretty well here. In terms of what's coming up this week, Monday we have Halliburton, Hasbro, IBM, Morgan Stanley. We have the Census Bureau going to announce September housing and building permits on Tuesday. And we have a few other banks coming out as well, Harley-Davidson. And on Wednesday, Abbott, Citrix. We have American Express, Coca-Cola, Biogen. That's going to be interesting to see what's going on with the biotechs. We have, of course, Texas Instruments. This part of the season, we start seeing that. SanDisk, which looks like it's looking to be bought. And Thursday, we have existing home sales, initial claims. And we have Google coming out, now called Alphabet, Amazon, AT&T, Capital One, Caterpillar, Dow Chemical, Dunkin' Brands, Eastman Kodak, McDonald's, Microsoft. There's a whole bunch towards the end of the week. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be pretty exciting, I think. We'll have probably investors taking a look at these numbers this week, putting it all into perspective in terms of what's gone on over the last couple of weeks to see, okay, where, what is the big earnings picture looking like? How is it shaping up? Let's take a look at what's happened. Let's take a look at guidance and maybe put a little bit of reality back in this market, because this bounce has been a little bit frothy. Now we're seeing that the S&P 500 at this point right now with current and anticipated earnings for this quarter is trading up about 18 times again, 18.5, I believe it is. And that's where we saw the high recently, where it dropped off back in August, down to about 16. So this recent bid, this recent buy on the bounce, the hope that the world is going to stimulate, we're going to see that more is coming out of Europe, even though they said, well, maybe not, we're okay right now, but we stand ready. In Japan, there was a hope that there would be some more stimulus, but now over the weekend, well, maybe not. We think we've done enough, even though inflation is coming down. And the Fed, who knows? They seem to be all over the place with their opinion of whether or not they're going to raise or not. And I'm kind of tired of it already, thinking that we should see a 25 basis point move and get it over with, at least get them out of the news. So anyway, lots coming up right there. If you do want to get in touch with me, of course, you can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Talk about Twitter in a second. And also go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where you can find out more about the Aero strategy. You can find out more about the TDI managed growth strategy and all the things that are available on what's going on our minds in terms of podcasts and DH Unplugged, etc. Quick note on Twitter. Seems at the end of the week, there was initially kind of a rumor that Steve Ballmer, former founder of Microsoft, former board member, not there anymore, it was rumored that he had bought some into Twitter, bought some chunk. Turns out that was confirmed on Friday. He bought a 4% position in the company, which gave a lift to shares. This could be exactly what the company's stock was looking for, some kind of backing by some institutional players that maybe would present itself as an opportunity for the company to finally start to either look like it could be on the road to salvaging what was left and the opportunity they have in front of them, or maybe even be rolled into another company. Now, Steve Ballmer doesn't have maybe the best record, but still, this is, I think, a good sign for Twitter at this point. And if you add to it the Jack Dorsey co-CEO or the part-time CEO situation, at least there's something going on at Twitter that seems positive. And this is going to probably do a continuation of the short squeeze we saw in shares recently from the lows we saw at the mid part of the month into where we are today. So keep a watch on Twitter. And a guest today that you all love, you enjoy hearing, because he is clear, concise, and he has lots of information to share. You guessed it, Frank Curzio is with us today from frankcurzio.com. He's a research analyst, writes a great number of newsletters. You can also listen to him on some wonderful podcasts, Frankly Speaking and Wall Street Unplugged. So I have a whole list of things to talk to you about, Frank.
I'm ready to go. I'm following your lead, bud.
Listen, there's an interesting rotation going on in markets. Something I've talked about on the show before, and something that's a little bit of a head scratcher, except for the fact that if you understand how the institutional managers manage with the reversion to the mean and their various rotation strategies, you can kind of understand that the underperformers sometimes will get love because they're underperforming by so much. But is this something that can actually hold the materials, the oil companies, et cetera? I mean, what's your thoughts on this?
It is interesting. I think the rotation has to do with the Fed, right? I mean, what is the Fed going to do? And you're looking at...
The Fed doesn't know what they're going to do, so don't ask me that question.
But this is the thing, right? I mean, the whole, like, the last 3-4 years that we've talked about this, how many, even longer, but the Fed, why do they have all their governors speaking out loud? Why do they go to events? Why are they on CNBC? You know, it's for more transparency, right? This way, there's never any surprises. And right now, where you're looking at record auto sales, prices of houses obviously have gone up, and earnings expect to decline a little bit. Year over year here, but net wealth is at a record high. We just don't have that formula where interest rates should be absolutely zero and short-term rates should be zero. They should be higher. And they're worried about emerging markets. They're worried about so many moving parts. But what's happening is they're not transparent because nobody knows what they're going to do. Is it going to be what are they going to do in December?
Right,
nobody knows.
Right.
So right now the rotation is okay, if they're going to raise, maybe, we go a little into financials now and maybe consumer discretionaries like Disney that haven't performed well. Let's get into those. The Nikes and Starbucks. But financials, utilities, whatever. But the rotation I think you're seeing is so dramatic because nobody knows what the Fed is actually going to do. I don't know if they're going to raise in December. I don't think they are, but maybe they are. I mean, for them not to raise, a couple months ago and then all of a sudden raise in December, it's almost like they flip-flop based on what people thought about the market. So it's... really, it's a coin flip if you know better than me. But right now, you're seeing the rotations go back and forth, which is creating a lot of volatility. Not an easy environment for investors right now.
Yeah. So, but just to back up for a second on the whole idea of the Fed, right? So, first of all, the FOMC, as they call it, the Federal Open Market Committee. These days, people with all the speeches that are going on and all the commentary, they're calling it the Federal Open Mouth Committee. That's a new name for these guys. Now, the thing is, though, that let's just... say that the Fed does nothing. Just does nothing. They never even brought up the idea of raising. Never going to raise ever again. Okay, they're going to stay pat with what they have, which is 0 to 0.25% interest rates. Plus, they have the reinvestment of maturing bonds as well as interest into bonds at about $20 billion a month or so. So there's still some quantitative easing going on. That being the case, and we see a slowdown occurring around the world, but also at home. We definitely saw that manufacturing numbers have slowed down, factory orders numbers have slowed down. We see that the jobs growth in terms of the unemployment rate, the official, not the initial claims, have kind of stabilized a bit. The thing is that if they don't raise rates, and we do see earnings continue, because they haven't raised rates yet, and earnings continue to slow down due to the dollar headwinds, et cetera, why is it that if the thought is that we do see more of a slowdown in the U.S. and things are going to just stay the way they are companies being bid up so much?
That's a great question. I'm very surprised at this recent rally heading into earnings season, which we know is going to be weak. But for me, that was a big surprise. There's so many risks on the table, including the transparency of the Fed we just talked about, including earnings declines. But I guess that may be expected and baked in, but there's a lot of companies that are expensive valuations. I mean, even the oil companies, the major oil companies, trading 18, 19 times forward earnings because those earnings are going to crash. McDonald's, very, very high valuation, trading as a growth multiple right now, even though sales are declining. So you're looking at these stocks going, wow, even the large caps that people own and saying, do I really want to buy these stocks at 19, 20 times earnings here when they're not seeing any sales growth? But they keep going a little bit higher here, and it may be a trend. But for long-term investors, very difficult buying these stocks now and holding them long-term at these crazy valuations.
Is it possible, something we've talked about before, that maybe it's not your average hedge fund, maybe it's not your average investor, your mutual fund that's buying shares right now that are propping up markets as they have been moving up high, so incredibly high for the last 2 weeks, let's call it. Is it possible that maybe Japan is now implementing their foreign stock purchases in a big way, because there's a lot of just a tremendous correlation to dollar moving higher, stocks moving higher, and dollar moving lower, stocks moving lower. And is it possible that maybe it's sovereign wealth funds, people who have like an infinite horizon for investing that really don't care and they just want to kind of buy at these dips, you know, buy the dip?
Maybe, but you know what? I just spoke at Las Vegas, and it was a Stansberry conference with my company, Uncommon Wisdom, which is a division of Weiss Sponsored. So they let me speak. I used to work for Stansberry. I knew all the editors there. And there's one guy I really respect, Steve Sugarud, who looks at all sentiment indicators. And his speech was showing how, you know, in August, we all know sentiment was horrible, but I didn't know it was the sentiment indicators were worse than during the credit crisis in 2009. And based on sentiment indicators and what he was saying, and even if the Fed raises, because he provided data that when the Fed raises, stocks go up, he actually compared this time today to 1998 with the NASDAQ. And people forget that the NASDAQ, they think there's this whole tech revolution during the late 1990s, but it was really 1998. I think the NASDAQ was at 1,500 and went up over 200% in an 18-month to two-year period.
Right.
And he was like, you could throw a dart at any single stock and you're probably going to do pretty good because the market is in a phase where it's going to go much, much higher. And here's a guy that does a lot of data, a lot of numbers crunching, who I respect. Maybe, you know, you're seeing that kind of you still have to see money coming into the market. But it's interesting to see at this period where there's so many negative headwinds that I'm analyzing that are making me nervous, that people are still pouring in money into stocks that are very, very expensive. More important, I don't mind buying expensive stocks if they're growing, but these companies aren't growing sales at all. The sales are declining. To me, it's kind of a red flag, and it's interesting. Is that money coming from Japan? You see sovereign wealth funds? I don't know, because I know every place else is terrible, basically, except for us. So maybe that's going to be more money into U.S. stocks, but it is interesting. You don't want to ignore the trends either, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, they could be a while. You can ignore them because they could be short-term flip-flop types of trends. On the other hand, obviously, longer term, you don't want to. But the fact of the matter is, this year, 2015, the trend has been down. Now, do we break that trend? Is it happening now? Will it happen later? Will we test the bottoms again? Will we kind of test the highs again? Is it just a technical trade? Because fundamentally, I don't see the trade, as you're mentioning here, I don't see the trade being fundamentally based for the most part.
You know, for the index, I mean, there's a lot of ideas that I'm finding, individual ideas that are cheap. But just like even, you know, I see the decline of the Russell. I see, you know, but just valuations of the stocks that are going higher when I don't see sales growth. So there are stocks I traded good valuations, but the ones that I'm actually seeing money being pushed into right now scare me a little.
Now, what about we saw this week that Walmart had one of its, I think maybe in history, its worst day ever of trading on markets. And what happened was essentially during an annual conference, a shareholder meeting, they had talked about maybe not even thinking that it would be a big deal, what was going to be the hit on earnings over the next several years due to the fact that they raised the minimum wage. They kind of across the board made a raise to everybody at Walmart. And this is going to impact their earnings by a substantial amount over the next couple of years, right? I mean, this is going to be pretty ugly.
It is going to be pretty ugly, and it was ugly even when the stock came down so much. I was surprised it came down so much. This is a stock I sold not long ago in my newsletter. I think that, I mean, a 10% decline in Walmart is huge in terms of market cap lost, right? It's one of the biggest companies in the world.
Yeah, like so, $20 billion in one day.
In one day, and it's still going, and it's, you know, it still went lower. But if you're looking at Walmart in general, I think what they're doing is thinking long term, because I know and I analyze businesses, and the most important part of businesses is people. And I'm going to give you an example of this. When you're paying people more money, they're going to do a much better job. They're going to, you know, like their job. They're going to go there. They're going to attract much better employees. And a good example of this is McDonald's, where, and even a lot of fast food places, because I have two young kids and sometimes we're really busy. My wife and I will, you know, just zip through and grab fast food. There's different workers in there every time. They mess up the order every single time. We stop going to the McDonald's by my house. There's other fast food restaurants where they're paying them the bare minimum. And these people just work. They're not good workers. They mess up orders, and it impacts your business. I'm not going to the McDonald's anymore by my house because of this, and I've seen this happen where, you know, the better employees, where are they going to go? Well, I'd rather work at Walmart than work at other places that are going to pay me less. And when you see that customer experience improve, it's a huge, huge deal. It may sound like nothing now, and you're like, well, it's not a big deal. Believe me, it's a big deal for anyone that ever went through a drive-through or people who make a minimum wage because they don't care about their job. They can work anywhere, and they're like, yeah, I really don't care. I'm going to take my time or whatever. Where McDonald's now, if you're paying them higher salaries, you can say, oh, you're not doing a good job. Okay, you're gone. And somebody else will be able to fill that position. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to come through because, you know, you go to Walmart. It used to be really terrible. Nobody knew what was going on. You asked for help. I think that's going to improve that experience, and long term, it's going to be very good for the company. Right now, it's going to take a hit on earnings, but they're going to get much better employees in there. It's going to be a better consumer experience. But again, this is something that's going to take place over the long term, and you know, look, it did crush earnings, but it shouldn't have been too much of a surprise. A surprise came down 10%.
No, it shouldn't have been a surprise at all. The fact is we knew the numbers. Analysts should have had this already baked into their analysis and their earnings estimates and whether or not. Listen, the stock was down 20% year-to-date so far before that particular hit. Took it down about 30-ish percent on the year. That's a pretty substantial number. When you look at a large cap stock with the market capitalization that Walmart has, and you know that's a pretty big situation, a pretty big hit. And you know we're not seeing this. This is not kind of a standalone situation. You know, you look at entire sectors. Let's go back to the oil sector for a second. You know, the oil sector took an enormous hit. I mean, to a point that it's still surprising that a lot more companies aren't out of business or have been acquired at this point. But what's interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of hope, I guess, right now that things are going to turn around because oil kind of, you know, ticked up a little bit from the lows. But you just recently mentioned that you had a conference in Vegas. And what I think the title of your conference was something like, you know, short everything oil, right?
Yeah, I actually told everyone to raise their hand. How many people have at least one oil stock in their portfolio? 90% of the audience raised their hand. I said, you should sell every single oil stock. 98% of them, because there's one little part of the sector that's going to do good, but the rest of the sector is going to do absolutely horrible. And after the data, I had a ton of people come up to me and said, yes, I am going to sell my oil stocks because it's a very, very dangerous market right now. And here's why. This is an area where I travel to every single shale area. I own oil assets, so I hope I'm 100% wrong. But if you're looking at how much oil is on the market, right, we've seen oil prices come down 60%, but supply hasn't come off the market. Why? You have Saudi Arabia flooding the markets, trying to hurt the U.S. producers, other reasons with China involved. You have Russia at record production. You have the U.S. still over 9 million barrels of oil. So why are the U.S., why isn't supply coming off the market? It's because these oil companies are sitting on $500 billion in debt, which is due over the next 5 years. 85% of their operating cash flow goes towards servicing this debt, right? Now, you're looking at shale producers, and the average price that they can produce, that break-even, is $55. We're below that, right? Below 50. If you look at the forecast going forward, almost everyone has oil prices below 55 through 2016. Goldman Sachs believes they're going to average 50 through 2020. But here's the key why there's still a lot of production coming online is because of the hedges. So 30% of production is hedged. That's going to go down to 11% next year. And if you look at the companies like Pioneer, who have the best hedges, EOG, those companies are down 35%. Not too bad considering oil prices are down 60%. But if you look at the unhedged companies like Continental, Chesapeake, which just restructured their debt, you're looking at Denbury Resources, SandRidge Energy, these companies are down an average of 80%.
Yeah, no, it's
okay. The hedges are going to come off the market tremendously. And just remember $55 a barrel, because if we're not above that, these companies are going to lose money for every barrel they produce.
Wait, why are the hedges coming off?
That's because they made them at much higher prices last year. They made them for a year or two. So at 90%, I think the Pioneer's production is hedged at $71. Wow. EOG, it's like 20% at $85. So you're going to see these hedges come off tremendously. And if they want to hedge, it's going to be, you know, near current prices. So it's going to be very, very difficult for these companies. Big oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, sell them. These are expensive companies. Earnings are going to climb by 35% on average over the next couple of years. They're sitting on net debt of $70 billion. These guys only have 5% exposure to unconventional reserves. That's fracking. So their break-even cost is like 70 to 75. Mm. So when you look at if we have an oil shock, or if we see, we also are allowed to export oil, or something changes drastically where oil prices go higher, that's different. That's fine. But if we see oil prices stay below $55, which is widely expected based on how much supply we have on the market, it's going to be a bloodbath next year. And you're going to see a lot of write-downs. You're going to see a lot of bankruptcies. The one area that's doing great is refiners. Margins are huge. They're actually importing oil. They change oil into byproducts like gasoline so that oil is cheap. Gasoline's on fire right now. There's a lot of good plays in there. If you want one really quick, is Delek U.S. Holdings, DK. Company just came down by about 25% because they had hedges on. Hedges are bad for these guys because margins are doing well. And it's a great opportunity to buy these guys. Pays a nice dividend, huge growth ahead. It was a one-time blip. I think that company's going to do very well over the next 12 months. But be careful if you own oil companies. Tighten your stops because it's going to get very dangerous for oil prices.
Stops would only be for people that recently owned them, because if you had stops sometime in the past, obviously they would have hit already. But the thing is that if... one of the things that's really interesting is that we did see that of course, oil started to tick a bit higher. Okay, oil companies really ramped very nicely. But but basically what you're saying is this
that led to the presentation that like has you right. saw a nice bump up in these stocks where you know it's almost like a dead cat bounce where there's a lot of shorts in them. And that's why I said, you know what, right now you should use this to sell your stocks because it's just a very, very dangerous market where oil companies, they have to produce to service their debt. And that 85% of operating cash flow, that's this year. That's with the hedges in place. Mm. And that's not even really to service the debt. That's just to pay the interest on the debt. So, you know, people are going out there scaring everyone with junk bonds and they should be. This is almost 15, 17% of the junk bond market. Very, very scary for oil companies. It's going to be great for the country with all the prices lower. And I hope Goldman Sachs is 100% wrong with their $50 average call through 2020 because I have a lot of friends.
Yeah, but they called also for a $20 oil.
They say it's going to hit 20. They could hit 20. That was
2 months ago, right? At the bottom of the oil. They said it's going to hit 20 and it just turned and went right up.
Yeah, it could go to 20. So, you know, I hope they're wrong and that they don't have the best track record for predicting oil because I know when it was at 140, they said it was going to go to 200, I think. Remember that?
Oh, I remember. Peak oil.
Yeah, so, yeah. But for me, right now, with the amount of supply coming to the market, the fact that these guys have to service their debt, and it's just a tough scenario for them. So, I mean, they really leveraged themselves. Why? Because we had low interest rates. It's easy to borrow money. They bought a ton of property. Nobody had oil prices this low. I mean, the people that called for $4 oil prices are the same people that called for $4 oil prices for 5 straight years, and it was 100. So you can't really take credit for that, seriously.
Right.
But it's pretty crazy. It really is.
So let's talk about the IPO market, because this is something that's been going on recently where I think it's kind of interesting, where a lot of companies are hesitant about putting their IPO on the market. One IPO on the market now, latest I think we saw was Albertsons that pulled. But we've seen, I guess the best way to describe it would be unexcited acceptance for an IPO these days. And, you know, in the past you have an IPO and they hopefully price it right. They do, they put some shares out, but they keep it kind of tight so that they can really squeeze the stock on the open. And that's the game they play with IPOs. And then they let out some more shares over time, et cetera. But the company obviously reaps the reward of whatever the IPO was. Plus, you know, the inside guys who own the stock get a nice pop on some of the share price when it moves up. But for whatever reason, maybe it's the quality, maybe it's the timing, maybe it's the skepticism, IPOs and the recent IPOs, not just IPOs, the IPOs that have come out over the last, let's say, year or so, a lot of the companies really ran up pretty good. Look at the GoPros, look at the Shake Shacks, and then they came down like crazy underneath and crashed right through their IPO price. And there's a couple of recent IPOs that came out where the stock didn't do anything on the IPO day. Some other ones that actually closed under their IPO price on their open, and now Albertsons is pulling their IPO. What does this tell you? Anything?
It tells me that they're very uncertain about market conditions, right? I mean, how bad could it be? Earnings are coming down. You have, again, what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, where there's no transparency at the Fed. What are they going to do? Are they going to raise rates in December? I mean, if you're going to really raise rates, what changed? What really changed in the past 2 months that you're all of a sudden going to raise rates in December? Other than people complaining and saying, what are you guys crazy? How come you're not raising rates?
So it's hold on a second. What really changed in September for them not to raise rates was the first question.
Yes.
That's the first question.
Yes.
Because, you know, you have to wonder, because they always use the words like it's a transitory situation, you know. But now all of a sudden they're worried about global concerns. They're worried about China and all this slowing down. And clearly we've seen every single number, whether they're believable or not, the fact is that they're lower. So if we just say, okay, we're going to believe whatever numbers there are out there from China. Okay, well, we're going to accept these. And everything, imports, export, imports were awful. I mean, awful. 17% or 18% decline over the last period. Exports were, I think, 1.1% decline. Internally, things are not going very well there. GDP may be in the sixes at this point. And we see that Europe is slowing down, manufacturing in Europe, and of course, the debacle in Germany with Volkswagen, which will hit Germany pretty hard because Volkswagen is such a substantial situation there. Plus, the commodity route that's really messed up the whole entire emerging markets or those countries that are the most affected by commodity-related types of products and production exports. But still, the thing is, you have unemployment at 5.1%. They can't say to us, well, you know, but if you really look at the labor participation rate, it's not so good because they've been not saying that before, trying to, you know, say how great it was. We saw that initial claims are back to the levels we saw in the 1970s. And the ISM Services Index is okay. That's doing fine. Inflation is ticking up. The last read was about 1.9% on year-over-year for the core, excluding energy and food. So generally speaking, while there may be a little bit of a slowdown, it looks like they got so frightened over a 0.1 or 0.2 change in things around the world because it wasn't new, and all of a sudden they're, you know, frantic about increasing rates by 0.25%.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and just listen to you explain that, like trying to explain what's going on. This is why within like a few month period, it's to me, and you know, the original question was about IPOs. I think, yeah, it's kind of hard. I mean, you want to time it right. Their First Data timed it right. Right. I mean, they're doing okay. It's going up and down a little bit, you know.
No, but First Data, which came out, they actually brought down the offering price mm-hmm. from where they thought it was going to be, a couple of bucks down. And that's a sign that there's a softer market for IPOs, whether it's because there's not enough money floating around, there's skepticism, people just don't want to just jump into anything, whatever the reason is.
Yeah, no, it was definitely brought down. First Data is a company that I actually like. I don't know if I'd buy it like on the IPO. But remember, a lot of this is short-term thinking. I mean, even I think it was 2004 when Google came out, you know, they lowered their offering price too. I think it was like $80.85 and, you know, it's up 10 times more. But it's more of a short-term thing. It's more about market conditions. You know, talking. I'm actually familiar with the First Data IPO. I think it's an amazing company. It was taken over. What was it? $27 billion in 2007 by mm-hmm. KKR, and now mm-hmm. has a $14 billion valuation. $10 billion plus revenue, huge growth. However, they're sitting on a massive pile of debt, which is like $1 billion in interest payments per year. But all that debt, because they almost went under. They almost folded this company because they bought it right before the credit crisis in like 2009, 2010, and KKR said, you know what? Let's put a little bit more money into this. So a lot of their interest rates is in the double digits on this that they're going to restructure. And I think they're going to see huge, huge growth going forward. So it's going to be interesting to see what it does. And what you and I talk about, Andrew, is more short term. They lowered the price. It's a weak market. And Alston's pulled it. But that should give you a little, you know, make you a little cautious,
well, maybe,
right?
Maybe what this is Albertsons, which went private and is coming back public. First Data, which went private and coming back public, right? Maybe this is more of, hey, you know what? The private equity stuff, maybe we don't want that. We want the companies that have new innovation that are exciting. And maybe that's why some of this is soft that's coming out. Some of the private equity back rolling into the public markets.
Yeah, no, that's a good point too. Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this happen. I mean, even the semiconductor stocks as well, where you know, you just take them private. It's all about money. It's all about money generation, taking them and leveraging them, coming out higher, cashing out. I mean, when you see a lot of this going on, it's, you know, is it really shareholder friendly?
Yeah, exactly. But exactly. No, it's not shareholder friendly. What they're doing they're dumping it
to the guys into the hedge funds. Right. It's very, very friendly.
The private equity guys are the ones that are really profiting on this. And the fact of the matter is, yeah. I could throw this out in a different way. If it was really profitable and a great opportunity, why the hell would they roll it back out? Right?
Yeah. I mean, there's advantages of, I don't know if there's too many advantages now being a publicly traded company, but you know, again, you can use stock and you're valued at much, much higher. You know, if you'll be hired, say even at a market multiple of 17 times, or private companies could be valued at 4 or 5 times, depending on what industry you're in. But, you know, you deal with a lot more headaches. But interesting. No, it is an interesting point. But, you know, the bigger point here is you're right. You know, that the First Data IPO is lower than expected, came out. And Albertsons, and it tells you what kind of market and the uncertainty out there, even for investors. So it is a nervous environment.
Yep. Let's talk a little bit about Apple. Now, in a recent discussion you and I had, I think on one of the podcasts, it was several months ago, and you had been pretty, I would say,
I was very bearish.
You're pretty bearish. Yes.
I was very bearish on Apple in the 130s. I really was. And I know that's the high, and but when it really hit those levels, for me, I think people, you know, would say, and you had guys like Icahn, and Icahn even came on. I think he's a genius, but he even came on, and you know, he owned at the 130s. He said it was going to $1 trillion. Valuation. It could go to 240, he said. So then, you know, here's a stock.
By the way, you know who the first one that said it's going to go to $1,000 or $1 trillion? In my recollection, do you know who the first uber bull was on that? A guy you know.
Was it Al Tucher?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it was Al Tucher. That's right. And then what happened is the stock came down to under 100, right? I mean, it fell tremendously, right, mm-hmm. Apple? I mean, mm-hmm. It came down, and then Icahn was on TV, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and it was funny. He said, you know, I still think it's going to be a $204 company, and you know, I was like, okay, then why didn't you buy the hell out of it when it was under 100? So you got to be careful who's talking about it sometimes, because if you really think that company's going to be 240 when you're talking about it 130, and it falls to under 100 and you don't buy any more shares, and you say, yeah, we're thinking of buying shares when it goes back to 110, you know, you got to be careful and you got to look at the numbers. growth is going to slow dramatically for Apple going forward. And it's such a big company. It's $250 billion in revenue they have to generate every single year. That's the market cap of almost, I mean, there's three, four companies, maybe a couple more companies that have a total market cap of that. And they're going to generate $250 billion in sales. It's very difficult for this company to do that. I see slow growth slowing in the single digits. Do I think it's fairly valued at 105, 107, and it's like 110. But for me, it's not that I'm telling you people to short Apple. I just think there's much better opportunities out there, whether it's a GE that pays a, you know, a nice 3% yield that's returning $100 billion back to investors. That's the market cap of McDonald's is $100 billion. They're going to return that to investors, and they have a growth model now with the industrial internet, with sensors all over their infrastructure. You have IBM out there where you could buy at a 15% discount to Warren Buffett's cost basis, a company I hated for the last 3 years, but finally their revenues have declined from $100 billion to $80 billion, and now they're focusing on, you know, the biggest parts of technology, the fastest growing, like cloud and data analytics and big data, you know, social media. And finally, you're going to see earnings growth in that company, huge dividend. These are companies that are in a much better position for growth and income investors compared to Apple, where you're going to see growth slow. And
by the way, this is also with a massive stock repurchase program.
And I'm factoring all the numbers.
Right,
like,
no, I agree.
Look at the... you know, $100 billion plus in cash. I get it. It's a fantastic company. I'm just saying, in terms of the stock price, when you look at how big that company is, almost every company in the world stopped at $400 billion, $500 billion. And then, you know, you look at the Microsofts, you look at all those big companies technology-wise. You know, EMC was up there too, where they just hit a level and they're like, wow, how do we grow from here? They came down. They started issuing their dividend. I mean, the fact that Apple started paying a dividend should tell you that growth is slowing because they're becoming such a big company, and it's a fantastic company. I just think for investors, you have to look at the bigger picture here. It's very difficult to generate $250 billion in revenue. Plus, the watch was a complete flop so far.
Well, that's I think was the big issue. That was the issue. I think you know, one of the things that Apple always had going for it, even from the early days, by the way, when they made some, I don't know if they made mistakes, but it wasn't widely accepted. You know, where the difference between the Apple OS and the you know, DOS OS back in those days, and that whole little beta versus VHS fight was going on. But Apple, since then, since they created the infrastructure, and it's not so, by the way, Apple's not so much just about the idea of, okay, they have a great device. That was the phone. Okay, I'll put that aside for a second. But really, the resurgence of Apple was all about the MP3 player as one example. And one of the things I talk about this a lot was during the early days of the MP3 player, because they were not the creators of this. But what they did was organize the software and the ability to have access to content in a way that was much better than anybody else had it. Otherwise, it was very difficult to deal with. And the thing is, they created not only the MP3 player, but at the same time, the organizational software to warehouse your music and your songs. And then to actually easily pass it back and forth to your device. And that was one big thing. But then I think they got the idea that, hey, man, it's not only about a device. It's about a whole infrastructure and a whole ecosystem. And that's what the iPhone and the Mac and all of us started working with the iCloud and everything that goes along with this. The thing about the iWatch, I think that it was an add-on. It kind of reminds me of the iPod Nano with straps.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with you. It's, you know, with the watch, it's, you know, and even when the iPad came out, I said, well, this is a big phone, it might not work. And I wind up buying four of them, right? Two for my kids, one for me, one for my wife, because we, you know, when we travel, and it's like a babysitter for the kids, it's the best thing ever sometimes. But with the watch, I mean, I hear people are starting to bring them back. And just to be clear, it's not so much that the watch would have been a success for 99% of the companies if they launch it. For Apple, I'm saying it's not a success because with the project to sell like 2.5 million or sold 2.5 million, and say the average price is $500, and you know, you're looking at that, that's over $1 billion, right? 1.2 billion. So that is a successful launch for every single company in the world except for Apple, who generates $250 billion in revenue. And that's the point I would tell investors here, where you look and say, wow, it's trading at 12 times earnings. Be careful going forward, because that multiple is going to go higher as they don't meet those sales estimates. As you know, of course, they're going to buy back a ton of stock.
But for Apple, which is a cash cow, what's their multiple now?
The multiple is what? Probably 12
times, 12 I think.
12 or 13?
So you can back out the cash and say it's at 10 times?
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying, so let's even say 13. Let's say 14. Mm-hmm. Let's say 15. Mm-hmm. That's only a market multiple right there. And the fact of the matter is this is a company that even without the watch, because if you say that the watch is not going to move the needle much in terms of revenue, it's also, if it flops, it's not going to move the needle much either. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
So the thing is that you have, I mean, what are they? They're a phone company. They're a music company.
I would disagree. I would disagree a little bit there. I mean, if it flops, it is going to move the needle because everybody knows that they need another great product to sell.
That's true.
Because they just launched a 6S that it's not different at all from their phone. You cannot tell if you picked up a 6S and a 6. You can't tell the difference. If you pick up a 5 from a 6, you could tell the difference easily. You can even say 6 Plus obviously is bigger. There's very little things. They'll say battery life, camera.
It's got the pressure sensitive touch. Yeah,
which
it's
got is
the
something
camera things.
That
it's got a few
nobody
things.
Really talks about or uses. The true touch, which is, you know, if you press it harder and stuff, that's like one of their biggest things. And I had someone on my podcast last week who brought up an interesting point. His name is John Petriti. He's a portfolio manager. And he said, did you see Apple's commercial? I said, what do you mean? He's like, Apple's commercial. He's like, I've never seen Apple in all these years be defensive. And that commercial came out and it was like, well, what's different? Well, let's show you what's different. Here's what's different with the new iPhone. Right, like they were very defensive. And not only that, for the first time, they're behind, like they're following Samsung, right? They're behind the curve where, all right, bigger screens may work.
Yeah, no, that was clearly an interesting move what they made there. By the way, I don't understand. I don't think we've talked about this. The iPad Plus. No, I get that it's faster. I guess that get that it has the touchscreen. I get all that stuff. But one of the things I don't understand is why didn't they take the MacBook Pro 13-inch, which essentially the screen is the same size as the iPad Pro, okay? And take that with a keyboard that's already built in, a much faster processor, all that, and put that a touchscreen on it. You could bend it backwards and do like they do on the Lenovos and the Dells and all these other ones, and you have a multi-use iPad / touch computer that's much faster because they already said, well, we got this. We're going to sell a keyboard with it. And now they got this Fakasta pen that they sell with it. I just thought that was a weird situation. Like they don't want, you know, they're so afraid of cannibalism of other products. And, you know, they usually cannibalize
their own product, which they do a good job of. And you know, they're able to generate higher margins. I mean, even, the iTouch. You know, I mean, well, why do you need iTouch for if you have an iPhone? So, I mean, at least if they're going to cannibalize, they do it with their own products. But again, it sounds like I'm really ragging on Apple, and I'm not. They're an amazing company. Our podcast goes on iTunes, and I tape it through Apple and Macs and stuff like that. It's a fantastic company, but it's gotten so big, and it's so much bigger than everybody else. And I even think if you're looking for growth look at Facebook. I mean, Facebook is unbelievable, Andrew. I mean, they're generating $14 billion in revenue. And think about this. There's $540 billion that was spent on the advertising market. And you look at companies like, you know, Starbucks, who walks in. I said this in my speech, too, in Vegas last week, where, you know, Starbucks goes to the cable companies and they say, okay, we want to advertise. And they give them this whole book and say, you know, the average age, the demographics between this time and this week, you can average on a show. And who knows if they're DVR or if taping. Or you go to Facebook and before you say anything, Facebook goes, well, there's 6 million people that just checked in right now to your store. You could send them something this second. What do you want to do? You can't compete when 20%, actually, to be correct, 21% of the world's population has a Facebook account. You always have new content, so people are checking it so much they're on an average appointment 20 minutes. They're just starting to revolutionize and this platform, and you're looking at Facebook statistics, and you may say valuations are really crazy. If you look at Apple, it's trading at 60 times earnings in 2004. Netflix was trading at like 75 times earnings in 2004. You're looking at a company that in 10 years jumped 1,500%. Mm-hmm. So as long as the growth is there, this company is going to see tremendous sales growth. They're only generating $14 billion in revenue in a market that's $540 billion. And they have by far the greatest advertising platform that's ever been created. So think about where revenues are going to go. If they capture just 15% of this market, you're looking at $80 billion in revenue and 500% sales growth. So I'd rather put my money on Facebook than Apple, who seems like Facebook is where Apple was in 2004 to me, and Apple's more of a conservative stock. And if it falls under 100, I'd probably say, well, you know, maybe you could buy it again. I think the fair value is 107, 109, around there, 105 to 109. But at 130, I just thought it was really expensive. Everybody loved it. Everybody had a buy rating on it.
Well, everybody owns it.
Yeah, but it's interesting. And if they come out with a new product or something, you know, I'm willing to change my mind. But right now, with everything on the table, this company's going to see single-digit sales growth and earnings growth going forward. And, it's evident right now. If you look at their P PE is at 12 and their forward PE is at 11. So if you look at that and they're close together, it means the company is not really seeing as much growth as people believe.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to happen going forward.
All right, let's talk about two more things before we go. I want to talk about you mentioned this, the Dell EMC deal, which seems very interesting in that Dell, a private company, is looking to buy EMC. Now, just to kind of refresh people on what happened here, that Dell came in with a couple different offers, and there was some rumors about what was going on, and finally put down, okay, we're going to do a $33 takeout of EMC. Now, EMC owns a piece of, or a spin-out of VMware, and what's interesting is they're going to issue a tracking stock for that, and they're going to use a bunch of leverage in order to get the deal done, and blah, blah, blah. Now, what was really interesting was that you would think that with a go shop offer, which allows the company EMC to go out and find other suitors that may want to buy them, that the potential for the top end of that deal is higher. In other words, maybe somebody comes in at 34, 35, then Dell comes back, oh, I want to take you out at 36. You know, this is kind of like the starting and opening bid. Meanwhile, EMC on the news does move up a bit. They come on CNBC, Michael Dell, and the president CEO of EMC, and they give a kind of a convoluted discussion about what's going on, how much debt, how this is going to work, what's the synergies, etc. And the stock is kind of like this, hangs around a little bit, up maybe 5-7%. That day it comes down. The next couple of days it comes down even further, kind of somewhere around $27 a share, with no obvious antitrust situations that are hanging around there. What is going on here?
It is interesting, right? I mean, the private company Dell, you don't even know how good they're doing, right? Because it's a private market. I kind of love it. You know, I love the fact that if you're an analyst, you can't analyze the deal because you don't know what's going on within Dell, right? I mean, you say, okay, this has definitely got to be a play on cloud computing, but how good is Dell actually doing? And you don't, I like it to the point where, you know, it's private, but they must be doing great since they went private, right? To do a deal like this. It does remind me of the old days and the deals with Compaq and stuff like that, and some mm-hmm. of the big guys trying to get together with hardware and software. But it's going to be interesting to see. I'd love to tell you that I could analyze this deal and see if it's a good deal, but you're right, because you know, with a private company taking this over, it's much difficult than if you have a public company, right? Because you can issue stock, you can do whatever, you can dilute shareholders. And the fact that nobody else came out and said, wait, you know, this might be a good play in EMC, which I think there's a lot of companies out there that could easily have bought this, makes me think like maybe, I don't know, I'm not too sure if this is going to be a good deal, but it's so hard for me to analyze. Everyone's guessing. I mean, people, I try to look at this deal to see why they're doing it. And, you know, it's cloud computing, but the fact that Dell's private, it's so hard to see, you know, what are going to be the synergies, what's going to be cut. And then you have, you know, the Justice Department, they might, you know, they, you know, it's unfortunate. I'll give you an example. What is it? Halliburton is going to take over Baker Hughes, right? Mm-hmm. And Halliburton, I think the Justice Department just came back and said, in order for this deal to happen, they have to sell some of their assets, which is normal, right? In big deals, yep, even if AT&T, right? But the key to that deal, which is funny, is that they said that they have to sell like a division worth over $1 billion or $1.2 billion to one company. How are they going to sell that to one company in the oil industry? Who's going to buy $1.2 billion in assets right now at a prime price in the oil industry? So I'm like, wow, this deal might not go through. I would take a look at this and see what the Justice Department is going to ask them to get rid of. And that might be a way to backdoor what this deal is really about. But for now, looking at the early details, and I did look at this, I wish I could tell you more, but it just seems like one of these two, you know, big, slow growing companies try to put themselves together and maybe shed a lot of assets. And you know, the synergies are going to be high because they're a little bit overlapping and become, you know, more as a pure play into cloud computing. But it is going to be interesting.
Yeah. Lastly, let's talk about biotechs for a second. Ever since the famous tweet on what's going on with regard to price gouging. And there's been a lot of reports out since on the whole area that looks pretty ugly in terms of the practices by many of these companies. Valeant was officially subpoenaed to provide information regarding their practices. And I've seen some really fascinating research on when Valeant takes over a company the next day or so, within reasonable short period of time, they increase the price of that drug by manyfold. And, you know, we saw that Pfizer and Bristol, they're all increasing their pricing dramatically on a regular basis. I think more than half the drugs inside the Pfizer portfolio were up an average of 66% for the year to date so far, 2015. That's some pretty big numbers. And now there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on them due to the whole political environment, the presidential campaign, things like that. What do we make of this whole biotech thing? Is this a buying opportunity?
No, I don't think it's a buying opportunity. I, you know, for individual investors who are listening to this, and actually I'll do it right now for you. If you go into Yahoo Finance, go into IBB, and again, I'm doing this right now, but if you do that and you put in a five-year chart and look at how much biotech stocks are up, it's absolutely incredible that the run that they've made. Now, it doesn't mean they can't keep going higher, but if you look at it, I mean, at its peak, it was up 350%, and the peak wasn't too long ago, right? It was about 6 months ago. It's up 350% compared to 70% for the S&P 500, one of the biggest bull markets in biotech history over the past 5 years. Now, you're looking now, the index came down, what, 20, 25%? But you're right. A lot of these stocks have been, you know, fantastic plays. There's definitely, you know, a lot of macro events taking place, right? You're seeing, you know, patent expiration, which is a killer. So what a you have the large companies, right? Who it's the Pfizer's and the Merck's. You know, once they lose that patent coverage, you could easily get it through generics and you almost lose all the revenue. So what they're doing is they're putting more investments into biotechnology to get these stocks in very early stages. So you're seeing more money push into the sector. But some of these valuations has gotten out of control. And you don't want to fight the trend. The trend was definitely up for a long time. I'm talking about companies with one drugs that have market caps of $1 billion. And if the drug gets approved and they take 30% of the market, it's going to be $1 billion, $2 billion. So the and if they don't, the stock's going to go, it's going to fall 70-80%. It's a very dangerous market. You have to be careful because the trend broke. I think you're going to find a couple of separations from the better companies, from the companies that have been very speculative. But the pricing on these drugs is absolutely insane. On the orphan drugs, drugs that are targeted for very rare diseases, you look, it's it puts the government in a really tough situation, mm-hmm. because even though the data isn't that great, and you could say, okay, well, you know, the study performed decent where it could help 10%, for you to say, okay, well, we're not going to approve this, and this is something that could help kids with rare diseases, politically, it's terrible. Yet, if you approve them, the price on these are $100,000, $200,000. I mean, you know, they only affect a very small part of the population, very, very tiny part. So the reason why these drugs trade so high is because they charge $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 for these treatments. And now that, you know, you have Clinton coming out and people noticing this, and yeah, what was the drug that she talked about? I mean, it was actually a drug that was on the market for 20 years, right?
A drug that was on the market for, I think, even more than that. And Martin Shkreli, a former hedge fund manager, bought the company, this small company. This drug is used, I think it's for some kind of a weird bacteria that you pick up, if memory serves me correctly, if I'm wrong about that, but just go with that for a second. Only about 2,000 people take it on an annual basis. It was like nothing, $5 or $6 or whatever it was per pill. And he jumped it up like to $700 a pill or something like that. And that's egregious, by the way. Now, his defense, of course, was the same as the other defenses with the drug companies. You know, we have to be profitable in order to do research. We're not here just to be kind and not make money and be just, you know, altruistically involved in the world to help people. Of course, we're trying to do that. But at the same time, we want to make money. And, you know, he has a requirement and responsibility to the shareholders. Therefore, if we're going to do R&D and we're going to try to get some new drugs underneath our belt or buy other companies or expand the company or whatever it may be, we got to be profitable. And this is one way we'll do it. I agree with you. It's a very difficult situation because I agree with both sides. As a consumer, I agree with the fact that this is ridiculous. It's going to cost me $200,000 to take this particular drug. On the other hand, as a human being, I'm like, you know, oh, but if it's $200,000, it saves my life. So what?
You're right. But let's talk about the whole industry now, because I read an interesting article where it comes to Viagra. No personal experience, I promise.
Oh, come no, on. I didn't read. Yeah,
no,
sure.
Really, though, I read the article, right? And when it first came out, it said that the pill was $10. I mean, not first came out. It was like 5 years ago. I think it was $10 a pill. It's $50 a pill right now. So you're looking at 400%, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
A 400% price increase, and look where inflation is, right? And so you look at, you know, average 2% inflation. Let's even say it's 2%. But 400% increase in a drug that's not needed to save people, right?
But more so, it's a drug that's out. Now, listen to this. You would think that the normal progression of a drug is it's expensive when it first comes out because it's got to pay for the research development and all the costs that went into this. And then it gets cheaper over time. Isn't that how things go?
But it depends, because the reason why things get cheaper over time, Andrew, the technologies, is because of semiconductors, right? Is because there's so much competition. But when you have a patent on something that no one else could produce, why does it have to come down? That's why a lot of these are going higher through the you know, as long as they have the patents on it, right?
It doesn't make sense that they go higher per se under this, under that scenario that you built, because it's just production of the drug at this point. And if nothing else, the stock, the drug price should stay the same. Going up a little bit, you know, to keep pace with expenses, inflation, things like that, makes sense also. But to go up fourfold over a number of years with more people taking it just for profitability is capitalism, and that's okay. On the other hand, you know, where do we get, where's that demarcation point where we say this is price gouging? That's the question. That's, I think, what is going to be the question.
Yeah, and as long as you have that uncertainty, and it seems like a great top, why? Because, I mean, look, the average person that votes is, are the people that take the most, you know, medicine and medications, right? I mean, that's a right, fact. I'm not right. saying anything. Mm-hmm. So it's an easy market. It's fine. They get the, you know, the demographics of, well, what can we talk about that's going to be a really high topic that we can get more votes? And this is one of them. So for me, as an investor, when I see the biotech industry, you're going to see this come out like crazy over the next year, which I think is really going to impact this sector, even when you do have those stocks that go up. But this is going to be a hot topic. It's easy to talk about. This is what voters are talking about. Why are we paying so much for healthcare? It's insane healthcare expenses. We all go through it. So I'm looking at it on a political level of how it can affect your investments. You're going to see this or impact your investments. Here it is, because you're going to see this as headline news and price gouging. You're going to see all this. And like you said, it's not necessarily price gouging. And I get capitalism. I'm not picking on these companies. The fact is, it's going to be headline news, and it could impact the industry like it did when Hillary Clinton first, you know, made that tweet. Mm-hmm. So just be careful owning these stocks. I mean, it may look like bargains here, but they're still up 300-400% over the past few years because they've had an unbelievable run. So just be careful, because as you know, who follows the technicals, who's great at, the trend's really broken down here, right?
Yep. No, all trends across the board are broken down on all sorts of things, and now they're trying to reestablish themselves. The question is, what's the move and the follow-through from here? The short-term trend has clearly changed on markets, right? We're back up a little bit from that, or a good amount in October from those, you know, horrible lows. But, you know, we did see a very consequential break of trend and directional move on trend. And the question is, you know, can, you know, is this a quote-unquote dead cat bounce where people are just like, oh, just buy the dip and let's move back in? Or is this, you know, something more that can be followed through to, you know, let's call it new highs in the future? Anyway, we got to end there. Frank Curzio, you can find him at frankcurzio.com, of course, and his great podcast, Frankly Speaking and Wall Street Unplugged. Make sure to visit him and listen in on his great podcast, read his stuff, and buy his newsletters. Thanks, Frank, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. Always a pleasure, buddy.
Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate it. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Do me a favor. Make sure to tell your friends, send them a little email, a little something to tell them, hey, you know, you can get this great podcast on iTunes or listen to it directly on the web over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or any podcasting apparatus or program that actually has them listed. And I'd really appreciate that. I look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.